evening, friends, and welcome to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe. I know you have lots of choices of how to spend your time, so you honor me greatly when you spend your valuable time listening to my show and my guests. Tonight's musical opening was by former guest and beloved wayshower, author, and drummer extraordinaire Lane Redman, who passed away just a few weeks ago. And later tonight, we will memorialize her life and play a bit more of her music. That cut was called the Yemaya. I hope you'll stay tuned and perhaps light a candle for her on your altar. With the Day of the Dead and Samhain just passed, when the veil between the worlds is thought to be thinnest, tonight, author, witch, teacher, and healing practitioner Christopher Penzack is with us discussing his latest book, The Mighty Dead, or one of his latest books. It's a book on the enlightened ancestors of the magical traditions, akin to the ascended masters, saints, and bodhisattvas. We'll explore who are the Mighty Dead, or are they the same as ancestors? And the various kinds of ancestors there are. Chris shares what he teaches about the soul, reincarnation, and the afterlife, and he'll also dispel the misunderstandings about witches' Sabbaths. And if you've been wondering about what that witch's flying ointment is, Chris is going to fill us in on all that as well. Then in the second half of the show, Kate Montana is with us. We'll be discussing her book, Unearthing Venus, which will have us delve into masculine enculturation, the loss of feminine values, and the devaluation of women in Western society. With the war on women making headlines every day in the U.S. political arena and global awareness of continued terrifying injustices against women and little girls, the market has never been more primed for this unflinching conversation. Yes, we're going to be talking about vagina values, as Kate calls them. But before we do, I wonder, did you miss any of these recent shows? We had Julian Rose call in from Poland talking about his book In Defense of Life, talking to us about fighting against war and greed mongers. Nikki Scully, her topic was planetary healing, spirit medicine for personal and global transformation. Kathy Pagano, Wisdom's Daughters and Symbolic Language. Matthew Fox and Adam Bucko, they co-authored Occupy Spirituality, A Radical Vision for a New Generation. In other words, sacred activism. Sam Daly Harris was with us. His book was Reclaiming Our Democracy, Healing the Break Between People and Governments, and he offered some good advice how we can heal the rift. And Sula Saad, the documentary filmmaker of the documentary The Unheard Feminine Voice in the Middle East. Yes, all that is there waiting for you if you missed it. And have you heard my new book, Goddess Calling, Inspirational Messages and Meditations of Sacred Feminine Liberation Theology, is making its way out into the world? Yes, it's passing through the birth canal as we speak. After gestating in the womb the last couple months, early bird copies are finally available directly from me starting now, and regular distribution will be out there in the world. That all happens in February when you can get the book from bookstores and all the usual places. But if you want to be one of the first ones to get a copy of my book and read it, perhaps you'll write a review for me, please go to my Goddess Store page on my website, KarenTate.com. If the specific button for the book, Goddess Calling, is not up yet, just scroll down to the bottom of the page and use the $20 PayPal contribution button. That is actually the cost that will cover the book and shipping and handling if you're in the United States. And I'm really, really sorry for my international guests. I can't very easily mail you a book. You'll have to wait until the book is available online, or you can order it from your local bookstores, which you could probably do now, as a matter of fact. And maybe you'll want to consider a few copies for your friends for the holidays. Yes, I'll be able to get them to you before Christmas. That's what the publisher tells me. And here's the buzz about the book from the back cover, if you don't mind me sharing it. I'm very proud of these endorsements. One is from Jean Houston. She says, a strong, courageous book that will either set your teeth on edge or make you laugh with joy. Reverend Selena Fox says, political perspectives to challenge oppression, ecofeminist theology to empower action, goddess meditations to feed the soul. Z. Budapest says, a magnificent work, carefully researched, beautifully organized, using inspiring language. Karen Tate is in love with life and the ancient wisdom, a very generous author who is a sister soul in revolution. Barbara Walker, Tate encourages all women to rediscover their sacred history, to break the shackles that patriarchal culture has imposed on them, and to take action for the preservation of our Mother Earth. Meditations are profoundly engaging. And finally, from Isadora Forrest, Karen brings her deep experience with goddess spirituality and the liveliness of her long-running internet radio show, Voices of the Sacred Feminine, to this inspirational book. So I thank these ladies, one and all. Dare I say, I think this is my best book yet, and I'd love to know what you think as well. So order a copy from me. I'll be glad to sign it, and please be one of the first to post a review. And if you're in the Venice area, I'll be at a screening of Femme, Women Healing the World, tomorrow night at the Spiritual Source Center on Rose Street. I hope to see you there. Be sure to say hello. And remember, if you've been wanting to see Femme and learn what all the buzz is about, learn why it's so important and what content it shares that's so vital to help us shift our world into a caring and sharing and equal society, please go to my website, KarenTate.com. On the first page, if you scroll down just a little, you'll see a link where you can either click on it to watch the film streaming for only $4.99, and that doesn't go to me, that goes to the producer. And there's also an option to download a copy for yourself for a bit more. You know, think about having your friends pitch in, make it a movie night, then a discussion group afterwards over a bottle of wine or some cups of tea. Get inspired, get motivated, get activated, and let me know what you think about the film. Again, I'm proud to say I'm actually in the opening scenes, and what an honor it was for me to be in this film among so many of my mentors. And finally, last bit of business here. I'll be priestessing at the Goddess Temple of Orange County the fourth Sunday of the month. The topic is gratitude, appropriate just before we celebrate Thanksgiving, and I hope to see you there. And if you've sent, been one of the people who sent in your great response to the magical moments I've been sharing from my Walking an Ancient Path book, I'm going to get back to that next week with a story about Sekhmet stopping the California day fires. But tonight we're taking our extra time to do a memorial for Lane Redman, and that is certainly more important. So, Our first guest, Chris, is up. I want to thank him for his patience. And if you're not familiar with Chris's work yet, let me read his bio. Christopher Penzack is a witch, teacher, writer, and healing practitioner. His practice draws upon the foundations of both modern and traditional witchcraft blended with the wisdom of mystical traditions from across the globe. As a practitioner and teacher of shamanism, tarot, Reiki healing, herbalism, astrology, and Kabbalah, he's the founder of the Temple of Witchcraft tradition and system of magical training based on the material of his books and classes. He's an ordained minister, primarily serving the New Hampshire and Massachusetts pagan and metaphysical communities through public rituals, private counsel, and teaching, though he travels extensively teaching throughout the United States. So, Chris, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Karen. I'm happy to be here. Congrats on the new book.
Oh, well, thank you. And I'm so glad we finally got our schedules in sync so you could be on the show. We've been trying all year. You're a busy guy.
I know. I'm traveling. I'm here, there, and everywhere.
Well, you know, it's
good
to be
busy. In fact, I'm only home for 2 days. I just came back from one trip, and I'm leaving for another tomorrow.
Oh, wow. Well, I'm glad I caught you in between here, and it's great to be so much in demand. Lucky you. So, The Mighty Dead, what a strange name. Where does that come from? Who were the Mighty Dead? Enlighten us, please.
The first time, at least the first reference I know in history to the Mighty Dead, actually comes from the writings of Gerald Gardner, who's arguably considered to be the founder of modern Wicca. In some of his books, he referenced the Mighty Dead as he didn't necessarily use the word enlightened ancestors, but the ancestors of the witches, of the Wicca. And talked about how if you were initiated into the witchcraft groups, you would have a chance to meet them and maybe someday become like them. So I was really fascinated by that idea, and I actually came to them through more of my New Age studies. I had left witchcraft for a short time to learn a little bit more about healing. And through that healing practice, I got introduced to groups that worked with the Ascended Masters and worked with the Great Lodge and had different names for them. But when we did meditations and vision works to the Ascended Masters, I always got these very kind of witchy people. I got the little old woman who lived by the edge of the village in Cornwall, or I got an old priestess from a Greek temple or an Egyptian temple. I wasn't getting the typical popular Ascended Masters that most people write about and talk about today. And it really kind of brought me back to my witchcraft traditions and roots and trying to find out, you know, well, where does this idea come from and the root traditions where I'm coming from. So I often describe them, they're like the saints, you know, in the Catholic tradition, or the Bodhisattvas in the Eastern traditions, or what we think of as the Enlightened Masters, the Ascended Masters in the New Age traditions.
Well, let me ask you, you have made me think about something I have not thought about for years and years. I had a dream once, very unexpectedly, about Israel Regardi. I think does that sound right?
Yep, that's right. Yeah, he was the former secretary of Aleister Crowley, yeah.
Okay, and he came to me in a dream, very unexpectedly. I barely knew who he was, but at the time there was a local Freemason group here that was working with my nonprofit, and we collaborated now and again, and so, you know, there was some association. Would he be considered one of the Mighty Dead?
Well, it's an interesting question, and I think, like, you know, sainthood beyond the voice of the Catholic Church, it's hard to say absolutely. Most people would think that a lot of the pioneers of the modern magical traditions are among the Mighty Dead, figures like Israel Regardi, and he was a part of the Golden Dawn system, and maybe people that were involved in that, or people like Gerald Gardner. The idea, though, is that they died with sorcerous power and wisdom and enlightenment to be able to step off the wheel of rebirth and no longer be present. So it's hard to say definitively, are the old teachers and the people who brought this information to us, did they die in that level of mastery? But one of the theories about the Mighty Dead is that eventually we all join this next level, and if they're really existing beyond space and time, they can come to us from beyond space and time. So their future, you know, enlightened self can kind of come to us through the faces that we know them best. You
okay.
might find in the Ascended Master traditions, there's a popular Ascended Master that everybody likes right now called Saint Germain. And Saint Germain comes up in a lot of the Reiki teachings and things like that. But in the lore, some consider him to be Merlin in a past life. So for people who don't really resonate with the name Saint Germain, he might appear to you as Merlin. So perhaps a future enlightened Israel Regardi from, you know, whatever incarnation that he makes it to, whether it be in the past, present, or future, can come to you, but through the face of Israel Regardi. So I've had ascended masters that I would think come from modern traditions. Like, I feel like I've been visited by Alexanders and, you know, so I wouldn't be surprised that Israel Regardi would be a part of that.
Now, Saint Germain, was he supposed, and I might be getting the wrong name here, and you can correct me, I don't care about that, but I've read some books about Saint Germain, who was supposed to be a master alchemist. Is that the same Saint Germain?
Yes, that is, actually. He's not the Saint Germain of the Catholic Church. He is actually the Count de Saint Germain, and he was a historic figure in Europe, and over 100 years, there's reports and sightings of him showing up in the courts of, you know, parts of Europe. And so
yeah.
we know there's a historic figure that had that name that lived for well over 100 years. And as the myth goes, is that he used his alchemy to attain ascension and immortality and stayed in a body for a longer than normal human life and then decided to kind of ascend to the next plane of consciousness. So
yeah,
he's considered a master alchemist.
Yeah, that sounds like him. It's been a long time since I read that book, too. But, yeah, you're making me dig deep, Chris. I'm going back in time here. Jeez, But speaking of alchemy, I might be getting off the track here a little bit, and I'll get back on, I promise. I wonder what your thoughts on that. Do you think there are really people out there who can do any of the things that some of these great alchemists profess to be able to do, or, you know, is it just a lot of hype?
No, I think alchemy is a very true and living tradition just as much as yoga is. I think it's less popularized, and I think a lot of people don't understand that there's an inner part to alchemy as well as an outer part. Usually the outer part of transmutation or immortality is really an indication of an inner level of attainment. So I don't know if too many people were, you know, turning lead into gold on the physical level. My kind of hero for alchemy was a figure named Paracelsus. And Paracelsus really tried to restore the medicine portion of alchemy and the doctoring portion of alchemy. So he was not the founder of modern homeopathy, but he really influenced the pre-thoughts to homeopathy and the like cures like kind of model in our modern era. But he was an alchemist, and he really pioneered some pretty profound remedies called spagyric tinctures. And there are ways of making plant tinctures in an alchemical presence of it. And the idea was that they were much more powerful, and he really kind of pioneered the idea of the relationship between medicine, immortality, divinity, and healing. And I think that's a big part of alchemy as well. So I think, you know, the idea of extending your lifespan and curing all illnesses and being able to transmute substances within your body, I think that happens, you know, in so many different ways, and I think they're all a type of alchemy. But I think there's actually practicing alchemists out there that are doing laboratory work and herbal work that really can do some amazing miracles.
So it's really how you define alchemy, I think I'm hearing you say, too.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of people, after Jung talked about it in his psychology, a lot of people tend to think that alchemy is strictly a psychological kind of contemplation. If you look in the East with the Taoist masters, they had a form of alchemy that was both an outer laboratory alchemy, but also an inner alchemy. And a lot of the things that we think of as energy exercises today are a type of kind of inner alchemy. And much of what we do with the chakras or the energy points for chi, you know, they were really intrinsic in the alchemical traditions of India and of China. And it was about transmuting the substances in your body.
Well,
I think outer
substances
help.
Would it be stretching the definition too far to say just personal transformation? I mean, if, as you evolve and become more aware or, you know, you raise your consciousness, wouldn't that even be a form of alchemy?
I think that's a type of alchemy. I would call that a spiritual alchemy. I think to be part of the alchemical tradition, that there's actually a transformation of either outer or inner substances. But I think people who transform their consciousness definitely transform their biology. You know, I think we switch on different genes, and I think we, you know, transmute illnesses and patterns that we carry with us. So I think there's a transformation going on there, definitely. Although I'm a big fan of laboratory work and the idea of actually, you know, making your potions and taking your remedies and making that to be a part of your spiritual practices as well, because I see within nature everything is holy. And, you know, that's really how I got into a lot of my witchcraft, was an interest in alchemy first.
Well, you know, I'm going to be having a guest on the show in not too long. I think her name is Barbara Forcrow, and she makes mention of how she had a dream about, she was diagnosed with breast cancer, and then she had a dream that she was supposed to go find the sacred rock and do a ritual there, and from that she was supposed to start teaching, and she hadn't been a teacher, and, you know, she just didn't see herself in that role, but she said after she actually went looking for the rock, she trusted in the dream because it felt like one of those special dreams. She went looking for the rock, she did the ritual, and she said she instantly knew after she did the ritual that her cancer was gone, and it turned out that it was. And
wow.
Is that sort of what you're talking about with sort of the, you know, healing the body and,
yeah,
you know, and the mind and body working in sync?
Usually in the traditional views, it's more of what we think of as energy exercises today, but I think ritual is definitely a way of moving energy and transforming ourselves. So I love hearing stories like that. I think that's a definite time of healing alchemy there, absolutely.
Right. Well, and I'm just thinking, wouldn't it be incredible if we all could teach ourselves to, you know, to cure the, you know, these horrible sorts of diseases. You know, I think Barbara is probably an exception rather than the rule, but, you know, how hard do you think it would be for, you know, the average person to actually do something like that? Would it take a lifetime of study or...
Well, I think the average person, you know, it's a harder time because the typical person's not really tuned into those things. You know, I think... I mean, I don't know if I would say it would be a lifetime of study, but I think sometimes when there's a need because you're diagnosed with an illness, there can be a greater desire to turn within and try to seek those answers. Although I've worked with a lot of people that have had really grave illnesses, and, you know, it either causes them to turn within or it causes them to really desperately seek outside of themselves. So I think it really depends on the person and you know, where their consciousness is approaching it and what level of dedication they want to have to it. You know, and also realizing that some illnesses, you know, it's what's the source of it. A big thing in alchemy and Paracelsus's work was what's the source or the root of the illness? Was it from outside, contaminations and circumstances? Then usually that's what's going to help heal it. Was it more spiritual forces? Was it more what we might think of as spiritual forces in the soul, like a karma? You know, and resolving that's going to heal it. So it's trying to figure out what's the root of where this is coming from. And how do I address the root of it? Because usually the physical illness is just a symptom of something greater.
Right. And then, you know, and that's not, you know, that's easier said than done, too, I would imagine, you know, finding out the root of what that is, you know, with certainty, you know.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, speaking of the soul, what do you teach about the soul?
Well, I teach in a system that uses maybe slightly different terminology than what some people are familiar with, but I teach that there's at least a three-part soul. Some will describe it as three souls separately, and others will just describe it as almost three parts or three organs to what we think of as the soul. And a lot of our teachings with the Mighty Dead, it differentiates when someone becomes part of the Mighty Dead or becomes one of these enlightened ancestors. How do they differ from somebody who doesn't? And it's the idea that these three souls, we can just simply call a higher soul, a middle soul, and a lower soul, that in most people, those three parts separate upon death. And the higher soul is more of what people think of as the soul from a modern perspective. And that the middle soul is more of what they think of as their personality or their identity in this lifetime. And the lower soul is more of this kind of animalistic side or animalistic self that deals with the biology. But it's also kind of a linking part between this kind of personal soul and this kind of transcendent soul. In older Christian traditions, they would describe it as the soul, the spirit, and the body. But, you know, we can use any type of name for it. It's just easy to talk about in terms of higher, middle, and low because it doesn't really invoke any religious fears or thoughts that people might have from other traditions. And
well, it makes
so
me think about the Egyptian tradition.
Absolutely.
You know, they have different levels of souls, too, the Ba, the Ka. I can't remember what they all are now, but
is that similar?
Soul.
Yeah. It's exactly it. This is just a more simplified version. If you look at some of the oldest views of the soul, there's at least a three-part, and then as different traditions, and one way I would describe it is almost like the soul is like a spectrum, and people will decide where the dividing lines between the colors are based on their own understanding of color. So the soul is like a spectrum, and people make their dividing lines based on where they see things are. Like the Norse possibly had a nine-part soul too, but the way they describe it is different than the Egyptians. So I think we're all kind of drawing lines in the different places. So the most simple view of it is looking at it as a three-part soul. And the early Hebrew traditions had a three-part soul that later became a four-part soul. Even in the Hawaiian traditions, the voodoo traditions, and some of the witchcraft traditions, we have this idea of a three-part soul. So I think it's a good model to start with. And then as people get a little bit more complex in their studies, you can kind of break it down further. But when somebody dies, the three parts usually separate, and that when someone dies in that state of enlightenment or that state of might and moves on to the next level of consciousness, they've crafted a vessel for their consciousness that can contain all three of those energies and kind of step out of the cycle of rebirth in a more holistic way, so those parts don't separate.
Very interesting. You know, the soul, I mean, the natural segue from that is to talk about afterlife and reincarnation. You know, some of my listeners probably would identify as witch, and some of them progressive Christians. My listeners are all over the place. But as a universal belief, do witches have a particular belief about the afterlife or reincarnation, or does it... You know, is it varied?
Well, I think it varies on the tradition of witchcraft. When witchcraft first became popular and public and people started talking about it, it was a very simplified model. There was this idea that one would cross the veil and enter into what was described as Summerland, kind of like a paradise, like a more terrestrial view of heaven, the idea that, you know, all needs were satisfied at that place, all desires were satisfied. And once you felt that level of satisfaction, you could move on from that level and return back into the cycle of rebirth and reincarnate. As witchcraft has kind of developed in the modern era and really tried to reclaim a lot of lost information that we've had in our traditions, it's become a little bit more shamanic, it's become a little bit more complex in its theology. So people believe there's a realm beyond the Summerlands that's really this realm of the enlightened ancestors, which some people call witchdom. And witchdom is the land of these, you know, kind of enlightened secret keepers of witchcraft, where all our lore is stored, and kind of like a combination of a heavenly realm and Akashic records all combined. But different witches personally, there's no, you know, real institution that says this is what the beliefs of witches are. So there's many witches that believe in reincarnation on more of a global level. where, you know, you can go from lifetime to lifetime in different places across the globe. Others believe that reincarnation is really a function of genetic memory and things are passed on. And what I really like about the three soul model, the way I understand it, is that it's a model that describes both those phenomenons. So your higher soul or your higher self incarnates globally. Some people would describe it like a soul bird or a spiritual bird that kind of climbs up to the top of the tree, and then when it's time to return, will pick an incarnating, you know, conception of a human forming, and then they will come into that and be able to kind of anchor themselves in this world. Where the lower soul is really made up of, one word people sometimes use for it is the blood soul. So it really contains your ancestral memories. It's very tribal. It's kind of made from a combination of the two parents coming together. And so it really, you know, carries those racial and genetic memories and family memories. So people who think that their memories of previous incarnations are strictly genetic, well, this model talks about why that is and how it's coming through the consciousness of the lower soul. But people who feel like they have very global memories in a very nonlinear sense, then that's really coming from the higher soul.
Hmm. Well, it's a shame. You know, there isn't a way for us to know until we pass over. you know, that's you know, isn't that you know, the bitch of it, you know? And then, you know, all of these ideas could potentially be right. You know, I'm of the mindset that I think we get what we expect. You know, if we expect fire and brimstone, if that's what we deserve, maybe we'll get fire and brimstone. And if we think we're going to the Summerland or the Isle of Apples or wherever, you know, I think it looks like whatever we think. But, you know, I don't know. I guess I'll find out one day, like we all will. So, you know, how does, you know, how would you say ancestral reverence connects with goddess reverence? You know,
most of the ancient pagan traditions had ancestral reverence as a huge portion of it historically. Mm-hmm. Even a little bit more so, like the idea of the household gods and the family spirits, you know, not to say came first above the other goddesses and gods, but they definitely were the first ones you went to because they were the closest to you. And I think that's something that in our modern spirituality of looking at goddess and god traditions and pagan traditions is kind of forgotten about. But the idea that, you know, the land that you lived upon had its own spirit, and there'd be like a house elf or house spirit or house shrine for it, and also the ancestors were very deeply connected to that. And the idea, you know, we have this kind of model that everything is very neatly divided into categories in our head and our culture. But the idea of the gods, the fairies, the ancestors, you know, from an earth-based tradition, they all kind of came back up out of the earth. You know, there was a deep connection to it. So they weren't a separate. If you read the old fairy lore, the fairies were living right next door to the dead. Sometimes the dead became fairies. Sometimes the fairies came back as our ancestors. And the idea that the gods and goddesses were often seen as these kind of primal beings that lived under the hills that we might think of as fairies or elves. The larger gods and goddesses, the more kind of cosmic ones, you know, were the primal movers of the universe, the ones we associate with the planets and the stars and the sun and the moon. But they were a little bit more distant in some ways, where the gods that were right beneath your feet, along with the ancestors, along with the nature spirits, were a little bit more immediately connected to you. So I think they play a really good intermediary role. You know, a lot of the traditions that I know often suggest to work with ancestors and land spirits and the spirits that are right around you before really trying to connect to the big cosmic ones, just because the cosmic ones are so vast. It can be harder to have that personal experience where the really anchoring yourself in where you live and the land that you're living in is a very important part of it. So I think some of the traditions are similar, but it's not necessarily the same ideas.
So for someone who wanted to maybe start to delve into that, would this be a good book to start to learn how to connect with those ancestral spirits or the spirits of the land?
Yeah, absolutely. The first part of the book actually talks about all the different types of ancestors that we have beyond the Mighty Dead, and it talks about how to honor and connect to them, because I think that's just as important as the Mighty Dead. And then the second half of the book deals a lot more with the Mighty Dead themselves, and as priests or priestesses in a magical tradition, you know, why would we want to connect to them, and how do we connect to them? The idea is that we connect to the Mighty Dead because they've had a human experience and then moved on to the next level. So how do we move on to the next level of consciousness? Well, the ones who've done it already can be our great teachers. but I think we, you know, are also helped out by connecting to the ancestors of our place, the ancestors of our blood, the ancestors of our kind of adoption and the family that we create, and kind of moving on from there. So I think, you know, a lot of the techniques of building shrines and altars and what types of offerings to make and what types of meditations you can do to kind of connect deeper with them are definitely illustrated in the book, and definitely can be helpful for people just starting with that idea.
So would you say the primary method is meditation, or is dreaming also, you know, maybe a way to make that connection as well?
Both of those are really big, but I'd say for ancestral reverence, the primary method is altar building and shrine building. The idea of actually giving them a physical place in your home, and by putting offerings out to them, particular offerings resonate and have a energy to them that allows them to connect a little bit deeply. So if you, you know, are doing the ancestor offerings and you're paying it, putting energy into it and time and attention and making physical offerings there, you may find that it's both a psychological switch but also an energetic switch where you might be able to make better contact in meditations and better contact in dreams. But the idea of making a physical space in your home for those who've gone before is really one of the key tenets for it. So even just setting aside a little tabletop or, you know, bookcase or something like that where you can put a glass of water and put a candle and maybe put out a shot of whiskey or, you know, whatever the favorite alcohol is of the family, or a cup of coffee, or, you know, anything that has a high alcohol content, a high sugar content, a high carbohydrate content are all ways that the spirits can kind of draw the life force, the energy out of that, and it can strengthen their connection to be able to speak with you clearly.
Very interesting. You're making me think about, I forget who I discussed this with, but more in, I guess, the Asian cultures, stuff like this ancestor worship or, you know, this connection with the ancestors, it's almost more of a requirement, isn't it? I mean, you know, you have to sort of placate the ancestors or they'll, you know, maybe wreak havoc with your life. But I'm not sure witches are so, you know, they aren't so intent as to, you know, to be thinking of it, you know, quite to that that degree. Is that right or wrong?
Well, I would agree with that. I would say the Asian cultures and the African cultures probably have the strongest connection to these types of traditions, and I think it's a much more cultural association. You know, it's that sense of this is what you do, this is a part of your duty, this is the way to keep things right in the world. I think because so many witches and pagans are reclaiming a lot of these traditions, we can look to the Asian and African cultures to kind of reclaim the technology, but I think our perspective is different. You know, I'm not necessarily worried about the ancestors coming back to harm me if I don't honor them, but I do think this is a way to build a relationship with and to heal some things that might not have healed, you know, in the lifetime with that ancestor. And also the idea that as we evolve and grow, you know, a Native American teaching is that we affect everything seven generations not only forward, but seven generations backwards. So the idea that our spiritual work actually helps the spirits of our ancestors that have gone before us and helps heal our blood and helps heal our land and helps heal our spirit. So I think having that connection helps facilitate that healing.
Interesting. You know, because so many people that I know, you know, they revere goddess, but, you know, they only think about the ancestors around Samhain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually went to a really amazing workshop when I was at the Heartland Pagan Festival. This was about 10 years ago, and the title of the workshop was Ancestors, Not Just for Samhain Anymore. And I really loved that workshop because it really, if you look at the traditions that have a strong ancestral reverence, they have the ancestor altar out, you know, separate from their magical altar, and it's 24/7, it's, you know, all year round, and you might feel the contact most strongly when the veil is thin in the fall, but, you know, if you look back into the history of things, like into the ancient Celts, you know, also Beltane, which we think of as a very life, fertility, sexuality time in May, that was also time for ancestral reverence. The idea of whenever life force is flowing, there's a greater chance for contact with the spirit world. So there's no reason to not connect in Beltane as well as Samhain.
So would the ancestors that you're talking about, could they be what some people might refer to as their spirit guides or their You know, for lack of a better term, I'm thinking, you know, of my Christian roots, you know, sort of like the, I don't want to say like the Holy Spirit or angels or guardian angels, that sort of thing.
It depends on how you define all those things, but I think ancestors can definitely be spirit guides. In the modern Christian context, a lot of people refer to deceased relatives that look over them as guardian angels. I have more of a Kabbalistic background with angels, so from my perspective, angels were never human, but I understand the sentiment and what people mean by that. So from that perspective of guardian angel, then definitely that's an ancestral contact. You know, and many people in many traditions describe that higher self that we're talking about as part of the soul as the angelic self. So I think there's a part of everybody that does have an angelic quality. So sometimes the ancestors can come across like that because, you know, in our culture, that's what a lot of people would be more comfortable with. You know, so if you see grandma or grandpa coming to you more in an angelic guise, you know, that seems more comfortable to you than if you see them coming in a more of a pagan view and a more terrestrial view, and that can be scarier for some people.
Right.
So I think
right.
They take the form, you know, that's most helpful to do the work.
Okay. And does the concept of the Mighty Dead, does it cross over into more mainstream metaphysical groups with the Ascended Masters?
Well, I think, you know, for me, I'm always somebody looking for the different bonds that connect the different traditions. And, you know, I've studied in a lot of different groups and a lot of different traditions, just really trying to see where those universal truths are. So I would say until I really wrote this book and started talking about it in this way, very few witches would really describe the Mighty Dead like the Ascended Masters. But I think if you really look at the properties of it, and if you look at the phenomenon, I think it is very similar. I think one of the bigger differences is that in the more New Age traditions, the idea of the Ascended Masters and working with very specific individual masters, much like you might work with an individual Christian saint, becomes a little bit more paramount, where in the witchcraft traditions, it's more of a collective consciousness. So there's the masters, kind of like how Brian Weiss in his books on reincarnation talks about the masters, and they kind of speak with one voice, but they're a collective consciousness. I think that comes across a little bit more in the witchcraft traditions, although specific entities can come out. It's not so much about who talks to you, it's more about what the collective consciousness says to you.
Okay. Well, and also, too, I'm curious your thoughts. Again, maybe it's just different terminology, but I know the Greeks often worked with daemons or demons. And, you know, demons have such a negative connotation in this day and age, you know, but I think back then that was really just spirits on another realm. Does that fit into this at all?
It's not quite the same thing, because in the Greek traditions, the daemons were not formally human spirits. They're intermediary spirits. They'd be more akin to what we think of as angels in terms of messengers, except they didn't use that term angel in that case. They're more of a lower spirit on the spiritual hierarchy, but they definitely weren't demons in the context of Christian demons. In the Greek traditions, I think it'd be a lot more similar to what we think of as the demigods or what we think of as the classic heroes. Usually those heroes or those demigods have these kind of spiritual journeys, and we might think of those spiritual journeys as more of an allegory or initiatory formula. You know, they each represented a higher divine power. It might not have been a literal case like in the stories of Hercules. But usually when the story ends in the Greek traditions of they were raised up to the heavens or they came up to Olympus to join with the gods, that shows a type of ascent like we associate with the Ascended Masters. But it's the idea that those spirits that were once human really recognized an aspect of their divinity and became closer to the gods. And I think that's more in line with what the Mighty Dead are.
Okay. All right. Well, I guess shifting gears just a little bit maybe, you know, I want to make sure we have time to talk about the Witch's Sabbat and the Witch's Flying Ointment. Why don't we start with the Flying Ointment?
The Flying Ointment, one of my favorite topics, particularly around this time of year. The Flying Ointment was, you know, as close to what witchcraft traditions have to a entheogenic sacrament. You know, you hear in a lot of different shamanic traditions, whether it's popular now from South America, ayahuasca or peyote or things like that, where people from a shamanic tradition would have some type of plant, that substance that they would eat, and it would help them have visions. Well, the problem was within European shamanism, what we think of as the old traditions of witchcraft and pre-witchcraft, the plants that they had the best access to were all very poisonous. They all had a very kind of dark underworld quality to them, and most of them had a very strong sexual element or a feminine element to them. A lot of them were named after are part of the Belladonna family, which has a very strong kind of dark goddess spirit to it. And so to be able to safely use them, and safe, I say, is just by measures, really wasn't that safe to use, they would mix the plants in proper proportions into an ointment. And the idea was that the ointment would prevent you from taking such a high dose of it at once that it would kill you and shut down your bodily systems. But it would give you enough of a dose that it was almost like killing you. It was pushing your spirit out of your body to have an otherworldly experience. But it wasn't necessarily so toxic that you couldn't come back. So they'd make these ointments out of a mixture of a lot of the belladonna herbs, but a few others, things like hemlock and monkshood as well. And they'd have some of them as healing herbs to kind of bring your spirit back, like cinquefoil. And they would smear them over their bodies, particularly in places where the skin is thin, so particularly around the genitals, the breasts, the armpits. And it was this idea that your body would absorb it. So you have to imagine when the Christian tradition comes in and, you know, sees this remnants of a fertility cult that spreads poisons while they're naked and cross, you know, sensitive parts of their body. And they all have a very kind of dark goddess and sexuality quality to it. You know, they're like, wow, that was really all the things we're afraid of, all the things we think are evil. You know, so it really is, I think, one of the reasons why witches have become demonized in the European tradition. I think if we just had a easier sacrament to have, it might have been less demonic in the Christian perspective. So,
well, you know, pretty soon I'll be having David Hillman back on the show, and you know, he got into all of this because he was a chemist, and he reads his own Greek, and he started reading all this pharmacology recipes, you know, from ancient times, and we're going to have a fun conversation because he talks about how in the ancient temples, the mystery traditions would take these ointments. And they would spread the ointments on dildos, and
yep.
Because it was it was easier to absorb these ointments if you took it in that way rather than ingesting it or something, and
right.
lots of ecstatic sexual orgies as well as medicine apparently. Being applied that way, so to speak. I hadn't heard of the way you just described, but that's...
That's what many people thought the broom handle was for, in all seriousness. So the idea that the witch was riding the broom, that was a way to anoint the genitals, and it was kind of used as a substitute dildo.
Well, yeah, I mean, he actually talks about the wands and the rods, and he believes even that caduceus was sort of, one of those, instruments hidden in plain sight that, you would use to, to apply these ointments, to
right.
the, in these other body cavities. And of course, the mores of the time then were so different than, after Christianity comes along. But I'm curious, are the recipes still available? I mean, do we actually know what, what ingredients and in what amounts they actually used for these?
The amounts are the sketchy part of it, which is why I usually don't recommend people experiment on their own unless they're working with somebody who really knows about it. The formulas have survived in various forms, but usually in the witchcraft trial transcripts, so they're often a little bit sensationalized. So we don't really know, how much of this is actual reporting of fact and how much of this is under torture. Most of the surviving reports we have, they say they mix it with the fat of an unbaptized baby, where probably it was most likely pig grease,
Right.
It was the idea that, they'd say that they would put soot in it to be black like the devil, but probably they just wanted to, be able to be disguised if they're doing this out in the woods and don't want to be seen easily. So the idea if you're, out naked under the full moon, if you're covered in a black soot ointment,
right.
less likely you'll be seen. So we don't really know the proportions. And the difficulty with the belladonna alkaloids, with the whole belladonna family, is that, depending on when you pick them in the season, they can have a different level of toxicity. One of the plants that I work a lot with is a plant known as Datura. And the leaves and the roots, when you see those in recipes, that always makes me nervous because depending on when you pick them, it can really have a high alkaloid content or a lower alkaloid content. the seeds are a little bit more consistent. So when I use them in incenses and potions and such, I will tend to only use the seeds and really kind of notate and do a little bit of muscle testing to make sure I don't poison myself or somebody else to find the right dose. So we don't really have a good understanding of how they were made in terms of what point in the season, you know, how they picked the plants, when they picked the plants. And, you know, it's not
right.
super scientific in terms of how many grams of this and how many grams of that. You know, it's a very loose
right.
measurement.
Yeah, just like we know about Cleopatra from her enemies, I guess, you know, we know about this stuff from, as you said, the, you know, the trial transcripts and things. So there
right.
hasn't really been anything that's been passed down from any hereditary witches or anything like that that we know of.
Right. I mean, people claim that every so often, but, you know, there's nothing that's really been substantiated, you know.
Right. Right, right. So the witch's Sabbath, you know, that's this time of year, too, that's all of that's usually sensationalized as well.
Right.
You know, what can you do to dispel, you know, those crazy ideas that, you know, that are out there in the world?
Well, the biggest thing that I feel like I can do as a practitioner and a runner of a temple of witchcraft is to make the Sabbaths public, you know, so people can come see and come join us. And, you know, they are serious rituals and they are ritual dramatic plays and trance-inducing events, but there's nothing illegal going on. There's nothing particularly immoral going on. You know, they do fit the context of our current society. Families will often bring their children if their children are well-behaved, you know, even though they can be intense. So I think the idea of being open and being willing to have that kind of open dialogue with people and, you know, now that we have a nonprofit and we're out in the public and have land and dealing with neighbors, you know, we invited them all over last year at Halloween and, you know, had a little Halloween party, meet the temple, and anybody wanted to come over and ask questions and see what it was about because we had our larger Sabbath the Saturday before just to make it convenient for the community. So I think openness is probably the best thing that you can do, you know, with that idea of the Sabbaths and the holidays. Technically, a Sabbath can be any of the 8 holidays for the Wheel of the Year. And in The Mighty Dead, I also talk about the Witch's Sabbath as kind of like the timeless Sabbath where the Mighty Dead dwell. And it's like an eternal celebration that happens in a sacred grove in the other world. And you can do vision work to connect to that eternal Sabbath.
And is this the time of the year that they sometimes do the Dumb Supper?
That is, yeah. Right around now, a little bit before Samhain to a little bit after Samhain, after Halloween, they'll have a Dumb Supper. And that's basically, you know, setting out a table and both the living and the dead eat there. So you'd be able to put out placemats for your ancestors and put out food for them. Sometimes it's just one symbolic seat amongst everybody. Other times there's a couple or for different sides of the family. And you have a meal ritually in silence. So usually someone will ring a bell to indicate when the silence is going to begin. And you eat in a very present way and really kind of silently remembering the dead and the ancestors you're working with. And then at some point at the end, a bell will be rung and people can speak again, and they might often tell stories of the dead or what they remembered from it. Or many people feel that the dead come at that time and give them messages because they're so present. And the actual presence
okay.
of the food is kind of like an offering. So it's a way to, you know, make a deeper
entice.
Connection. Yeah, entice. And you know, the life force of it can help enhance the connection between this world and that world.
Right. I'm wondering, does music ever play a part in this? I mean, can you entice the mighty dead or the ancestors raising energy with music? I mean, because you talk
Absolutely.
About the foods are potent and attract. Does music and chanting and sounding, does that all work too?
That can work, I think, particularly for the mighty dead, because I think if you're working in a witchcraft tradition, doing, you know, tribal drumming and doing chants that are appropriate for a witchcraft celebration, I think it's interesting to work with your blood relatives, who for most of us are not pagan or goddess reverent or anything like that. But playing their favorite music around the time of the holiday can be a good way to kind of entice their presence. I knew somebody recently who talked about how they were playing a lot of kind of Frank Sinatra-era music, because that's something that her mother liked a lot. And so to kind of entice her mother's spirit back, I particularly play a lot. My mom was very into both opera and Broadway. So, you know, around this time, I play a lot of that as well. And, you know, also the offerings don't always have to be at Samhain. You know, traditional holidays, believe it or not, I make offerings at Christmas. I make offerings at Easter. Even though they're not holidays that I celebrate now, in my spiritual faith, those were times that were important to my family members. So
or
I remember
birthdays.
Them on their days.
Would you say
birthdays,
like birthdays?
Yeah.
Yeah,
birthdays, anniversaries of deaths, you know, things like that are important days to remember the ancestors. And so, you know, I'll play things particularly for my mom on her birthday, and, you know, I'll play things for my aunt on her birthday, and different ways of kind of connecting to them and kind of enticing them back with their favorite things. And it's not so much you're calling them back because they can't connect with you, but it's a way, music and offerings are a way to give energy to strengthen the connection.
Right.
You know, wherever
right.
we put our attention is where the connection goes.
And, well, does that help them also connect with us? I mean, it sort of like becomes a battery that they can sort of tap into to cross over to tell us whatever it is they might feel they need to tell us?
That's absolutely right. And I think saying battery is a great way to put it. In the old spiritualist circles, when they used to do seances, you know, it was a minimum of two because you needed someone acting like the battery to kind of ground it, and you needed someone who was actually going to bring the message through. I think one of the difficulties we can have in kind of modern channeling and modern seances is when one person's doing it all, there's really not that build up the energy to kind of hold the space. So
it's just like when you're a priestess or a priest in a ritual, it's hard to be the one pulling in the energy while you're, you know, trying to make sure everybody hits their cues and, you know, does everything they're supposed to do. It's almost as if, you know, one person should be the channel while other people do all the other assorted jobs, you know.
Yep, absolutely.
Well, you know, you mentioned a trance in ritual. You invited the neighbors over and stuff, and I realize that's a public ritual, but you're making me think about an interview I did with Carl Ruck, who, you know, has studied the Eleusinian mysteries, you know, pretty intensely, and unless I'm confusing him with another guest, you know, because I've talked about this a few different times, you know, there's all of this mystery around what really happened in the Eleusinian mysteries, but I think sort of the general consensus is the attendees probably were given some sort of a hallucinogen, and they believe maybe they saw Persephone or something, you know, at you know, resurrected or something at in the Eleusinian mysteries, perhaps. Do modern covens do much of that, you know, or is that even still taboo? I mean, to work with, you know, hallucinogens with, you know, in a safe environment with people you know and, you know, in a protected space to maybe help lower that veil to, you know, connect with deity, get messages, whatever.
Absolutely. I would say for the most part, most modern covens don't experiment too much with the flying ointment we talked about just because it can be dangerous. And most, for the most part, would not, or at least would not admit to working with anything that we consider to be an illegal substance. And a lot of the hallucinogens of the European traditions, like for the Eleusinian mysteries, one of the theories is that the hallucinogen was ergot. And ergot is a fungus that grows on rye, and with Persephone being the goddess of the fields and flowers. But it's very, you know, you're able to poison yourself on that pretty easily, and it's very hard to cultivate and extract. They actually believe LSD, you know, is a form of ergot kind of extraction. They're related. And so it can be a pretty intense experience. Most modern covens will do a variety of oils and incenses and various potions and brews that can help stimulate psychic sight, but they're probably not as potent as like a peyote or a ayahuasca or ergot. But I think they do definitely help. I think the advantage of being in a witch's coven is that you also get a lot of training. So where the mysteries were really kind of open, you know, in Eleusinian mysteries, they'd kind of do a starvation diet to kind of fast and to get you into that space. And they'd immerse you into darkness, and there'd be a lot of rituals leading up to it. In some cases, they thought it was 7 or 9 days. And then you finally have that final sacrament. A lot of modern witches don't have that luxury. So, you know, we may have a weekend intensive, or we might have a day or a very long evening where we do particularly initiations. This type of thing happens. And so we'll probably do substances that don't have as long of a lasting effect in the body, and it might not be as intense, but with the training, it definitely, you can have a very deep experience.
Yeah, you mentioned food deprived. You know, I've found that also being sleep deprived tends to help. But I'm wondering, you know, if you feel it's safe to mention, you know, what type of, you know, herbs or, you know, potions. I mean, do you have that in any of your books that wants to use something that's legal and, you know, they wouldn't get themselves in too much trouble but might sort of, you know, give them a little bit help?
Yeah, I actually talk about that in pretty good detail in a book called The Gates of Witchcraft. The Gates of Witchcraft is all different trance techniques, and there's a specific chapter on plant trances. So it talks about the history, and it talks about some of the more dangerous things that have been used, and it actually talks about ways from marginally safe to very safe, you know, and the things that people can use that are based on my own experiences and my own training.
Okay. All right. So your Gates of Witchcraft book. Well, Chris, this has been fun, as it was last time. Is there anything else you'd like to share with listeners maybe I haven't thought to ask you?
That's, you know, I think in the end, just particularly around this time, but around the whole year, really just to be reverent to the ancestors, you know, whether it's just putting up a photo if you don't want to do a whole altar or, you know, doing something, just kind of keep them in your hearts and minds. I think that's the most important message I want to leave people with.
Okay. And please, so that my listeners will know how to reach you, and I'm sure you must have a website where all your books and all sorts
right.
of other good information would be available. Could you share that, please?
Sure. It's ChristopherPenzak.com, and Penzak is a little funny. It's P-E-N-C-Z-A-K. And also TempleOfWitchcraft.org are the two best places to reach me.
Okay. Well, Chris, thank you so much, and I hope you'll come back on the show again next year. It'll
so
be next year
to.
Before we know it.
Exactly.
In fact, it already is next year, isn't it, from the wizard's
yeah.
perspective.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much. I had a really great time.
Well, me too. And, yeah, we'll definitely do this again. Thank you.
Thank you. Blessed be. Bye-bye.
Blessed be, and good night. Well, listeners, I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. He's always such a great guest, and I love the insights that I receive from him. I really encourage you to go back through the archives and look for our past interview, because we've talked about a lot of other interesting things. I remember one thing, Chris, an idea he really put in my head that I hadn't thought about before was we were talking about archetypes and how Isis and Horus is really a great archetype for a single mother raising a son. And I thought that was so relevant in today's society, you know, with so many single mothers. But anyway, next up, as we cross the threshold here into the second half of the show, I wanted to share with you a word from Jo Carson. I have to thank her. She is the producer of the film Dancing with Gaia, and I want to thank her for having me run her commercials because it helps me pay for airtime. And if listeners would like to also help me keep Voices of the Sacred Feminine on the air, yes, that's right, I actually pay for the airtime so my guests can share their wonderful work with you, please go to my website, KarenTate.com. Click on the Goddess Store page. It's the last button on the left-hand side there. Go all the way down to the bottom of the Goddess Store page, and you can make either a contribution in the amounts listed there, or you can actually alter the amount. It would be greatly appreciated. And remember, no amount is too small. It all adds up. Imagine if 100 listeners just donated $5. That would go a long way to helping me pay for the airtime of the show. But here's Jo Carson.
The psychic state is the collective unconscious, which is that consciousness of the planet. It's called the cosmic mind, the mind of the earth.
Our ancestors understood that the animal and the divine were all connected. They were together, that there wasn't a separation. And that's what we are trying to return to, is that sense that our animal nature is divine. It doesn't get in the way of the divine. It gets us closer to it.
What's your idea of being fully alive as a human being? Because that's what's really spiritual. Write it down. Start writing your own Bible if you want.
That's the sacred. And by that, I just mean sweaty, fun, happy sex.
Well, that was some of the dialogue and sounds from the trailer for Dancing with Gaia. It's a feature documentary about earth energy, sacred sexuality, and the return of goddess as Gaia. It's a sincere film that goes deep into the connections between these important topics, and the DVD comes packaged with a 45-page mini-book that expands on the material in the film. And you can get it all at dancingwithgaia.com. So, again, holidays are upon us. You might want to think about that, you know, for your friends and loved ones if you are stuck and just don't know what to get them. So I want to remember Lane Redman. She was on the show a number of times, and please, as I mentioned earlier, please go back and listen to some of our wonderful interviews. I'd like to start Lane's memorial by playing some of her music. I feel really honored that she would have let me use her music here on the show. And before I start playing Lane's music, I want to say to Katie that I see her on the switchboard, and I will be getting to her in just a couple minutes here. But first, I think I'd like to play Invoking Aphrodite, which was some music of Lane Redman, who passed away recently. So first, let's go ahead and hear some of Lane's music, and then right after that, we will be getting to our wonderful interview with Kate, and so appropriate that we're playing Invoking Aphrodite, because we're going to be talking about Unearthing Venus. And in just a few minutes. So there's a little bit of a connection there, a segue. So here is Invoking Aphrodite by the late Lane Redman, our beloved wayshower, drummer, author. Here's Lane.
Smoking with incense. Cold water sings through the fruited trees. Everything is shaded under the bower of roses. And from the shimmering radiance of leaves, an enchanted sleep drops down. Here is a meadow of spring flowers where horses graze, and a soft wind gently breathes. Aphrodite, pour your nectar into our golden cup. In grace, make the libation. Bring your melissas to life.
Of Invoking Aphrodite by Lane Redman, and it goes on for another few minutes. I will try at the end of the show to play a bit more of Lane's music. I have her final Delphic Oracle as well as her Bee Mantra. But in the words of Miranda Rondeau, and I totally concur, it is with deep sadness that I share that on Monday, October 28th, our dear friend, frame drummer, teacher, muse, inspiration, trailblazer, bee priestess, goddess of the drum, she left her earthly body and took flight into the next realm. Lane was diagnosed with cancer in June and given 2 months to live, and she lived these last months to the fullest. She said it was the best days of her life. She was cremated October 31st, and people globally gathered to honor and send her off. Students of hers gathered at the beach, and offered a song that you can find on Facebook. And if you'd like to get those specifics from me, please just email me. She was born August 19, 1952. She passed away October 28, 2013. And here's one of her quotes. "We are always together in the place of blessings, flourishing on the bank of the calm wind, filled with our song of satisfied creation, radiant in the pulse of all that is, of all that ever was, of all that ever will be. We begin again, to begin at the beginning, to end again, to end at the beginning. We begin, to begin, to begin at the beginning, to end, to begin at the beginning." Lane Redman lived her last days with courage, grace, and determination to finish her film and the new edition of her book to be reprinted. She has inspired thousands of women and men with her book, When the Drummers Were Women, and has taught and inspired many to drum over the last 20 years. She has changed many lives along the way and opened a path for many women to drum, to create sacred ritual space and follow their dreams. She's left a legacy of resources to be continued to be shared for generations to come. She's written a number of books, recorded many music projects, written articles, created instructional material on CD, DVD, and YouTube, designed her own line of signature series drums with Remo, produced films, and has researched and collected thousands of images of women's frame drummers recovering their spiritual historic significance. She was known as a master frame drummer, teacher, author, historian, mythologist, composer, recording artist, filmmaker, educator, world traveler, yogini, and MV priestess. All the women frame drumming pages are dedicated to Lane Redman. She will be greatly missed. We are in deep gratitude for the path she has paved for many along the way. May your flight return home be full of peace, love, and light. May you always be in the hearts of all those who have been touched by you. You can leave a special note on her profile page on Facebook. Just go to Lane Redman on Facebook. For more information about her, go to laneredman.com or youtube.com/user/hatnofer, H-A-T-N-O-F-E-R. There's lots of other pages dedicated to her. There was a tribute by Wendy Griffith on The Wild Hunt. Wendy Griffith is a women's studies professor and friend. You can find there more information, or there's a tribute at Drum Magazine. There's a tribute at Percussive Arts Society. Yes, I want to thank Miranda for allowing me to read this. And say, Lane, we miss you. We are so appreciative of your work, and we are so lucky to have been gifted at having you in our lives. I imagine you sitting at the feet of the goddess, playing your drum, making her smile. May she embrace you in her golden wings. We'll miss you, and come visit us. Well, that all said, next up is Kate Montana. Kate, welcome to the show.
Hi, Kara. Nice to be here.
Well, and Kate, you know, I haven't had a chance to actually communicate directly with you. I've been communicating with your publicist or assistant, and I want to make sure I have it right. Is it Kate or Katie?
It's Kate.
It is Kate.
And
okay.
It's Kate, but a lot of people call me Katie as well.
Okay. All right. Well, let me share with listeners your bio, and then we'll start our chat, if that's okay.
Wonderful.
Okay. Kate has worked in network television for ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN, ESPN, and BBC. She's worked in radio, newspapers, and marketing. Now her passion for self-realization and the discovery and implementation of feminine life values and sustainable lifestyles has impelled her into the literary world. former publisher of the online magazine The Global Intelligencer and the wildly popular Bleeping Herald for the international hit film What the Bleep Do We Know. Kate has published hundreds of articles in the mainstream press, including the Seattle Post Intelligencer and the Tacoma News Tribune. She also worked with worked as the Northwest Bureau Chief for the national Native American newspaper, Indian Country Today. She's a co-author of The Heart of the Matter, Discovering Gifts in Strange Wrapping Paper by Hay House, with Darren Weissman. Co-author of Ghetto Physics, Redefining the Game with What the Bleep Do We Know, creator Will Arntz, and co-author of the screenplay Zentrophy, in production with Hollywood filmmaker Betsy Chase. Currently, she's writing a sequel to Unearthing Venus called Unearthing Shadows. She's a public speaker and has a master's degree in humanistic psychology, and she lives in the Pacific Northwest for now. So, Kate, welcome to the show. Thank you for your patience.
Absolutely. It's wonderful to be here, Karen.
Well, you know, what you talk about is not a new subject to my listeners, but, you know, it's always interesting to hear it told in a different way, and I think it's so important that we constantly need to be reminded. I listen to Rachel Maddow all the time, and just in the last week, you know, we hear about, you know, what's happening to women's rights across the country. It's scary, quite frankly. It's unimaginable that in 2013 we still have to worry about these things. And it's no wonder you say Western women are not truly liberated, but I'd like to hear directly from you your take on that.
Well, I must admit when I went and looked at your website, Karen, that I thought, oh, well, Karen and all of her listeners are probably much better versed in the goddess than I am. I'm a late bloomer. I was your typical, well, I don't know if there's anything like a typical liberated woman, but I was so liberated in my own mind that I just ignored the entire feminist movement. I didn't think it was for me. It was like, well, I'm already liberated. I can work where I choose, and I can take lovers, and I can get married and divorced and buy houses and cars and rack up credit card debt, and what are they talking about, liberated? And it wasn't until I reached my 40s, late 40s, that I seriously began to wonder what was missing in my life. I'd already in my early 30s kind of turned away from the whole external material worldly success route. I kind of burned out early working in network television and finally after that kind of went, wow, it's not all out there. It must be, you know, happiness must be something that's birthed within. So I'd already been on a spiritual path for almost 20 years. But there was something missing, and when I was on assignment and I was doing an interview with a man by the name of John Perkins, he told me a story of a shaman, and that changed my life. And we got into a whole conversation about men and women in different tribes in the Brazilian rainforest down in the Amazon. And he was explaining to me that there the men and women were, you know, varied from tribe to tribe, but mostly men and women were considered equal in the hierarchy, but men did men things and women did women tasks. The guys hunted and they fished and cut down trees for huts and canoes and weapons, and the women did the wild edible gathering and the caretaking of the children, et cetera. And he said that for most of the tribes that he was familiar with, men and women were equal on tribal council as well, but that there was one job that only the women in the tribe could perform, and that the survival of the tribe depended on that function. And I was thinking in the back of my mind, kind of like, yeah, having kids. And he just laughed at me, and he said, no, he says, that's not it at all. He said, it's amazing that so many of the tribes people down there have a great recognition of sexual roles, how men operate, how we tend to function as men and women. and our psychological and profiles and our strengths and our weaknesses. And he said the men recognize that they're doers. They're out there very aggressively focused on goal-oriented tasks. And the women are much more balanced as far as relationship and are in touch with their bodies and in touch with the needs of the community and the tribe and very much in communication with the Mother Earth and the environment. And so he said men being these aggressive drivers, he said they would cut down the trees until there were no more trees to cut down and fish until there were no more fish in the rivers and hunt until there was no more game. He said so it was the women's priority and their main task to tell the men when to stop. We've got enough, guys. Take a break. And when he told me that story, it was like everything in me stopped. I had never contemplated, you know, I'd read Men Are From Mars and Women Are From Venus, and that was about it. And I'd never really contemplated sexual roles and let alone, you know, the different balances, the way the sexes balance each other. Mm-hmm. And I was beyond shocked, and I realized that I'd been raised to be one of the guys.
Right.
I'd been raised to go out and cut down all the trees and feel like king of the hill and fish and hunt. And I took all of my self-identity through how well I was doing in the world, and I compared myself, I measured myself against the masculine yardstick.
Well, you know, unfortunately, you know, our generation, you know, or people close to our age, we don't have a lot of role models, do we, you know? And, you know, we're sort of blazing this, you know, this new trail with our pink machetes, so to speak, you know. We're trying to figure out, you know, how to do it with, you know, with a lot of trial and error. And, you know, right there in that story is the it is the answer. And it's in wonderful contrast to how our patriarchal system actually works when you think that we have less than 20% women leaders in academia and, you know, as our politicians in Congress, and, mm-hmm. you know, leaders in religious institutions. You know, the everything that sort of keeps society glued together, you know, mm-hmm. women are not at the forefront as leaders and look at the world because of it.
Absolutely. And I think what really started to get me was that not only are women not in, is the male-female balance is not interested, balanced in politics or, you know, as CEOs, et cetera, as you just said, but that so many of the women who have managed to get their way to top roles have done so through masculine methodologies.
Right.
And by working as a team member with the guys and doing it like the guys do it, and because that's been the benchmark of being able to even have entree into the higher echelons of power as we know it. And so I could only use myself as an example. I knew that I intimidated so many of my what I considered my softer, more feminine women friends because, you know, I just came on like a guy as far as work and aggression was concerned. And I never even, I looked at any other way of doing things as probably as like most men in the past have viewed the softer, more relational, more responsive interaction that women do so well and gone.
Right.
That's
right,
ineffectual.
Right. Well, yeah, well, I mean,
sisters,
you
know,
you probably, you know, had to do that to get to where you got and to stay
exactly.
where you were. And,
exactly.
I mean, and it takes a lot of courage to sort of shift that paradigm. And, I mean, let's face it, you couldn't do it yourself. I think there needs to be a lot of women standing shoulder to shoulder, or at least a few, to start that, you know, start that trend, don't you think?
Absolutely, and more than anything else, and this reason I wrote the book, I was compelled by spirit to write the book, is that recognition is so desperately important. I can't tell you how many conversations I've had women, both friends and strangers that I meet along the path. And when I start talking about how women are only liberated to work as men and to think as men and act and progress as men in a man's world that's been, you know, our educational system was designed by men, our ethics and morality and religions have been created by men, our political and economic systems were designed by men, and I'm saying, wow, it's really not liberation at all to be liberated to be a man in a man's world. That's not liberation of the feminine spirit.
Well, not only that, but when you think about the institutionalized discrimination, you know, women making, what is it, 70 cents on the dollar and less if you're not a white woman, you know, you still have white men, white religious men telling women what they can and can't do with their bodies.
More and more.
Yeah, I mean, so there's lots of areas where women really aren't free. I mean, I come from the South, and I have a friend who I speak to now and again, and, you know, I love her dearly, but she's not very intellectually curious, and she doesn't follow what's in the news. And I said to her once about institutionalized discrimination against women, and she says, well, you know, if women don't like how much they're making, they can just go work someplace else. Well, you know, she didn't understand that it's institutionalized. It's everywhere. And if women are discriminated against just in that one way for their lifetime, they are behind. I mean, they lose like over $400,000 in income over the course of their life.
That's correct.
You know, we just don't stop and think about these things, you know. And women really have to, you know, have to be the ones not perpetuating the patriarchy. Women have to be the ones fighting to uplift other women, you know, instead of being like the lobster pot. You know, you ever seen that expression where, you know, the lobster as a metaphor for the woman is trying to climb out of the pot, but the ones down in the boiling water keep wanting to just pull her back in?
I hadn't heard that.
But we all know it's not good out there, but I just don't think some women don't understand just how under the thumb of patriarchy we still are.
It's incredibly subtle, and you know, for example, just today I was reading the Huffington Post, and there was this wonderful article about some recent discoveries about cave painting. And by a Dr. Dean, oh my God, somebody or other, he was an anthropologist at Penn State University. And it had always been the automatic assumption for generations that most of the cave paintings, like at Lascaux, had been done by hunters, by the men.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden this guy is realizing that no, most of, by far and away, 80 to 90% of the cave painters were undoubtedly women, because the handprints indicate that, I didn't know this until I read the article, that women's index and ring fingers are generally the same length, whereas men's are highly varied. And by just going by a physiological view of the hands and the prints themselves, it was like, oh, no, the majority of the cave painters were women. But, I mean, there's this epidemic whitewash of white masculine, you know, it's always, you know, God looks like a man.
Right.
Just look at the Sistine Chapel. I mean, there's the proof.
Yeah.
Of course, the cave paintings were done by men. Everything was done by men. And there's this
amazing
whitewash.
Well, and the problem is our mythology shapes our society. And if our mythology is a male god, then we have male authority. And we see, we see the problem. And that's why, you know, feminist scholars get so annoyed, because even, you know, there's even sexism in academia. There's sexism, you know, when archaeologists are out there at the site, deciphering what they're uncovering, you know, and they have this patriarchal bent to it. I mean, I know women who have been arguing with Ian Hodder about Chatel Hayuk for years, you know, because Maria Gimbutas and James Mellor, you know, said one thing about the site. Ian Hodder comes along and says something else. I mean, not that scholars ever agree, but the point is, you know, they only see things through a male lens, Mm-hmm. And, you know, as a good friend of mine, Tim Ward, says, you know, that's like looking, you know, through only one of your eyes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But it's just astonishing to me, Karen. And I'm such a case in point that I was utterly oblivious to this until for 50 years.
Yeah. Yeah. But you woke up, you know.
Well, I woke up, thank God. And the view just gets more and more shocking as I go along, I have to admit.
Well, you know, Kate, I came to this not real early in life either. I wasn't one of these women who was born into it. I mean, I started figuring this all out when I was in my early 30s, and it took me about 15 years to get to where I am today to understand the full extent of it. It's insidious. Like you said, it's subtle. And if you're living in, if you're an evangelical or you're living in the Bible Belt or someplace like that, you know, this is just normal, you know.
Mm-hmm.
This is just normal. Even if you know that you're sort of a second-class citizen, you just think it's normal. If
mm-hmm.
you see that you're a second-class citizen, if you know what I mean, you know, you
mm-hmm.
might not even recognize you are.
No, it's just, as you said, it's the boiling water you're swimming in.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just
the way
it is.
Absolutely. Well,
Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
No,
go.
Please. Okay.
Okay,
I'll
so
you, Alphonse.
I will go.
Yeah.
I want to talk about your penis values of power,
oh, yes,
possessions.
Absolutely.
I'd love that.
We're right on the same page. That's where I wanted to go, was all about values. I read so much of the feminist issues and articles that are going on online, and I'm really, it's just like, oh my God, can we not be concerned whether we have black feminism or heterosexual feminism or gay feminism or Miley Cyrus taking her clothes off or whatever it is? Can we kind of like refocus on equality as a value system of bringing women's values into equal prominence and recognition and importance? And it was, I mean, it's going back to that story I talked about the Shuar tribe down in the Brazilian rainforest, is that the different value structures of the men and the women were recognized by both sexes in the tribe, and the tribe was politically organized so that the different value structures of masculine and feminine would balance each other out.
And they're supposed to be the ignorant heathens, right?
And they're supposed, of course, they're the ignorant. Yeah, absolutely. And the reason I got very blunt with values and how I wanted to say it, my editor at Watkins was kind of like, God, well, I suppose we can say penis values. I was like, well, you know, we use the word vagina. Can't we use the word penis? It wasn't the word vagina that they were flinching over. It was using the word penis anywhere near the marketing on this book. And it was an interesting discussion. I went, hi, guys, don't you see that's prejudice right there? And they were like, oh, yeah, certainly is.
Yeah,
and,
yeah,
and
yeah.
The reason I used such blunt terminology was I skirted all over the place to go, well, let's say sacred feminine values, the goddess values. Having come from such a diehard, I'm already liberated and thinking like a guy in a guy's world, every time I used to see words like the sacred feminine and the divine goddess, I would just, part of me just shuddered. I had a visceral reaction to it because I'd been programmed to dismiss that kind of terminology out of hand. And I was like, oh my God, now that I'm realizing how important sacred language and sacred grasping of what our earth is and what our bodies are comprised of and the spiritual component of all things in life, it's like, how can we not talk about sacred everything?
Right. So penis values, you know, we didn't
mm-hmm.
actually say what the
okay.
1, 2, 3, 4 P's are. Why don't you
sure.
get the 4 P's of penis values?
Actually, P just seems to kind of go with it. Starts with power. The masculine is very much into power, possessions, profit, property, progress, product-oriented instead of end result, prowess, proof, enormous physicality, enormous pride, and in terms of opposition, highly polarized. in many of their in many positions. So the more I looked at more masculine values, the more they all seemed to start with P, and so that's what led me to penis values.
That's so true. That's so true. You're so right on. And I mean, you're describing capitalism, you're describing patriarchy, you're describing the Republican Party, you know, you're describing Christianity. I mean, all of that, you know, all of these different, you know, groups or, you know, that really have the, you know, have things so totally out of balance. Because, you know, if I were to describe a goddess ideals, I mean, I would have to say it's, you know, it's closer to socialism, you know.
Absolutely.
And you know, it's closer to socialism because we care about all of us. You know, it's not about, you know, it's about power with, not power over, you know, not about possessions and consumerism that, you know, that plagues us. You know, I really do believe that, you know, they have a society so trained and brainwashed, you know, to keep being these uber consumers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it goes against, you know, everything that's got us. I mean, we don't have to continue this, you know, this unfettered growth because it's not sustainable. You know, we really should be thinking about developing ourselves. You know,
unfettered growth is a cancer.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Especially when you have, you know, finite resources. But I love that penis values. I hope you put that everywhere.
Thank you. And it was so interesting because, of course, having been raised in a very masculine mindset, very left brain and intellectual, so I've got all these penis values to start with a P. So what do you think I immediately tried to do with vagina values?
Tried to find V's?
Yep, tried to find words that started with a V, and I didn't find a single one. I suppose there's
I was going to have you tell me what they were because none popped into my mind right away.
None popped into my mind except the word value in and of itself. And then I went, well, you know what? That's really appropriate because the feminine is so unfettered and so unlimited and so unbound and so not concerned with rules and law.
Yeah.
It was just like, okay, the rules are off. The vagina values don't have to start with a V. And so I started finding words like surrender, the ability to surrender, which, of course, a man just shudders at the thought of, you know, surrender is the ruination of all.
Well, I will tell you one P that really is vagina values, but unfortunately it's a P, and that's partnership. You know,
absolutely.
I think that's one of the big values of the sacred feminine that unfortunately starts with a P, but you know, but the partnership,
a.
you know, is a,
again,
is a big
no
one.
Again, no rules.
Yeah.
No rules. Peace. Women are very peace-loving creatures.
Yes, 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 yes.
Just don't just piss us off.
So I'm curious, Kate, you know, now that you have shifted and you're out of this, you know, this sort of masculinized atmosphere that you were once in, are you still friends with the people that you used to rub shoulders with every day? I mean, and if you are, I mean, how do they see you now? I mean, I'm just curious.
It's my life is really the same as far as my relationships are concerned because, as I said earlier, I had already made a shift from sheer consumerism and materialism in my life back in my early 30s and had really started a very deep and powerful inward search in meditation and Eastern religions and studying energy systems. And so I live in a very spiritual-oriented community, and all of my friends are just completely wired for sustainability and like labeled GMOs. So that's the whole crowd I work with. When I made that switch from my back in my 30s when I was still working in network television, I'd pull onto a site I worked in sports television. So, and I started in the early 1970s. I was the first woman engineer ever to be hired for ABC Sports and work on a remote location. So it was me and
You were really with the guys.
I was me and a 40 to 50 man crew over and over and over again. And
yeah.
Working football and basketball and hockey and you name it. And I went from being a real potty mouth. Hey, there's another one, potty mouth. Hard drinking, competitive woman to, you know, who is out drinking the guys under the table after work, and, you know, hanging out in the motel rooms and watching the other sports, you know, casters and criticizing other sports coverage on other networks. I started carrying spiritual books with me, and I would just quietly go back to my room with a pot of green tea after the game. And so I became totally unfun and a complete puzzlement. And everybody certainly respected my choices, but it swiftly got me out of that environment, because when you start opening up and becoming less hard-edged and much more vulnerable and available on a spiritual basis, you just start opening up all over. And I just network sports television was way too harsh a world.
I would think. Well, and I mean, you know, let's face it, besides values, vagina values, values of the sacred feminine, feminist values, whatever we want to label them, I mean, you know, there are things like, you know, intuition, sharing, caring, mm-hmm. partnership, you know, trying to create win-win situations, mm-hmm. you know, and...
Supportive.
Yeah,
process-oriented.
And you know, and these are things that are looked upon in our patriarchal society as weak, you know.
Right.
And we have to struggle, I think, to reclaim those things and make people understand that, you know, that's why our world is so out of balance, you know, because
mm-hmm.
these things have been relegated and, you know, demonized, minimized, marginalized, whatever you want to call it, and by association women. And we haven't even talked about yet, you know, the over-sexualization of women, also
oh,
the benefit
God.
Of men.
That's right. You know, I, one of the things I wanted to point out, and again, this goes into this incredibly subtle realm, is the very words that we use now to describe. I mean, the early Taoists had no problem ascribing yin and yang qualities, and to be seen as to have a passive quality about you. When I was first hit with yin, feminine, darkness, passivity, submissiveness, and I was like, no way, Jose, you're not tying, you're not roping me into those disgusting, you know, kind of words, because I had masculine definition of what those words meant. Passive meant somebody who was just a couch potato blob with no drive and no ability.
Or a doormat
to be walked over. But what the Taoists were talking about, no, passivity is the great quality that gives you the peacefulness, the beingness that allows you to actually surrender and receive information.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, because you can't really receive if you're not in that mode.
No, you can't. And if you're switched on all the time, you're like a buzzsaw going through the forest.
Right. There's
no balance to that. So I would look at words like submissive, and I'm like, oh my God, submissive. But it's like, that's the last thing a man wants to be. But to submit to spirit, that's no hard task. I mean, that's not a bad assignment, to submit to the divine.
Right, right. Well,
and
even
so,
surrender, you know, you find out there's, you know, such a liberation in surrendering, because, you know, in one sense, you know, I think of that as meaning, you know, you learn you can't control everything.
Absolutely. And who doesn't want sexual surrender?
Yeah. Yeah.
Therein lies so much intoxicating physical bliss. And the number of women that I have met in my life who have had a lot of trouble in the bedroom, and, you know, when I've talked to them, and, you know us women, we'll talk about almost anything, it's just like they've never been able to surrender. They're too wired. They have to perform. They have to be this. They have to be that. You know, is their stomach flat enough? You know, are their breasts perky enough? Are they doing it right? And it's just like, and I listen, and I'm like, oh, my God. This is all, you know, we're all in our head and trying to analyze and perform. And that's another key word,
perform. live up to patriarchy's view of beauty. I mean, look at the millions of dollars women spend with cosmetic surgeons. You know, there's actually a big thing now about anal bleaching because heaven forbid that little area of your body shouldn't be a little bit darker maybe than other skin on your body. I mean, is that just insane? Or
that's
women
insane.
Getting these vagina rejuvenations?
Yeah.
You know?
I
don't know. I just think it's nuts.
Yeah, well, we're trying to get away from genital mutilation in certain tribes like in Africa, but then women are doing it in Scandinavia.
Right.
You know,
right.
Let me have labiectomy or something, labiectomy, something like that. It's just like, exactly. And it's I've just gone from shockwave to shockwave, Karen, is when I really, really stopped and looked at the whole over-sexualization of women in the last 50, 60 years, I've gone like, well, who've been the people who have benefited the most from sexualizing women to the degree, let me see, we're supposed to be available all the time, we're supposed to be hot to go all the time, we're supposed to want it all the time, we're supposed to be available all the time. It's like,
and
wow.
At the same time, we're supposed to pick up the dirty underwear, take care of the kids, be the mother, you know.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, my God, it's the guys who are winning out on this one. And the women, I forget what the name of the book is. There's a wonderful book out by an English woman who has taken a look at alcohol consumption in the last 30 years in women and the number of women admitted into detox centers for alcohol and drug abuse. And it's absolutely massively skyrocketing in the last 30 years.
Well, it very well may be skyrocketing, but I remember my mother. My mother's in her 70s now, and I didn't realize it at the time. I only started realizing it after I started knowing about this sort of thing. But I think it was in the Feminine Mystique that they wrote about this. I mean, women of that generation, to cope, they took what my mother called nerve pills. You know,
right?
So they had to medicate themselves to endure their lives, and that was just normal. I mean, how, you know, it's insane, really, when you think about it.
Well, what's frightening, Karen, is that it's increasing. It's not decreasing. There have been some studies in the last 20 years that have been very controversial about that. In some studies, have indicated that women's quote unquote happiness quotient has been actually decreasing since equal rights and greater liberation, and I wish I could. I don't have the exact study at hand, so I don't remember the name of it, and it's been refuted all over the place. But there's tremendous indicators that women are still medicating themselves at ever higher rates.
Well, it doesn't surprise me because women are left doing everything in most relationships. You know, not only do they have to go out and work now because one income isn't going to cut it, but, you know, they're also the ones that, you know, have to take care of the kids and be all of those things we just described, you know, the sex partner, the mother, the maid. I mean, you know, the woman comes home and her second job starts if she doesn't already have a second job, you know.
Yep.
So, women have it. Women have it darn hard, and I think that white male privilege is something that we don't talk enough about.
No, it isn't. And to get back to how women have it hard, and back to the subtlety of this, the permutations are just astounding to me, Karen. Is that if we get back to value structure, women are out in the world and they're working at men's job, getting paid anywhere from, as you say, 70 to 83% of the general pay rate of a man. And there have been psychological studies that have been done on women's satisfaction in the workplace. Men can be satisfied in the workplace with titular power. As long as they've got a hot-sounding title, they can be happy. And a little bit more money, they don't have to actually have actual more authority in their job for men to be satisfied at work. The case, that's not the case with women. Women will not take superficial titles and run with it and feel like they've gotten anywhere. And so I was thinking about that, and I went, well, that makes sense. But even deeper than that is that women are out there busting their tails, doing it like the guys, in guys' jobs, again, for men's values. And
well,
in
I think
jobs
so often, too, women have all the responsibility but none of the authority. And
yes,
that's always difficult as well.
Absolutely. But even if they do have the authority, are they allowed to implement women's value? Are they allowed to implement relational values? For example, a woman becomes head of marketing a da-da-da-da-da corporation, and they're taking over another company, and is she allowed to come in and say, well, what about the people that are duplicated in their jobs? The normal approach is, we'll hire the one that's, keep the one that gets paid less. We'll keep that one on, and we'll fire the other one. It's just like that women come in and go, well, what about those people? What about, we can't just lay them off.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not allowed to go into those relational value concerns.
Or the woman
like
may
wimps.
Be smart enough to say, look, is it really smart to hire, keep the one who makes the least? Because the other one may be more experienced, and that would benefit the company in the long run.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. But I think it just, if women are not allowed to implement values that actually mean something to them.
Right.
That are
right.
About taking care of people, that relate to caretaking and sustainable actions, no matter what the industry is. I think that women, and I don't even think that this is conscious for the most part yet, Karen, women aren't allowed to express in that venue, in those sets of values, that are life-sustaining values, not values that are all about profitability at any cost.
Right, right. Yeah,
those
kill
the soul of man and
woman alike. That from their job satisfaction is
absolutely
going back to, yeah.
So it's back to this incredible need to raise the importance of human values to the forefront of everybody's consciousness and go, hey, guys, sharing and support and relationship and cross-cultural and nurturing, these things have to be witnessed, and we have to adopt laws. Don't even get me into law. Oh, God. That's a very masculine headset. But if we don't do that, we're missing the boat. Then we're just creating more CEOs and more politicians that are doing it like the guys.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because if women, like you have your Sarah Palins and your Michelle Bachmans, if we have more of them in Congress, what good does that do,
No, it does. It's terrifying.
Yeah. Right. Well, Kate, we are starting to run out of time, and I don't want to, cut you short at the very last minute. We've covered a lot of the things we intended, but in the last, 3-4 minutes here, what have we not covered that you think is, some of the most important points you want listeners to know?
Oh, boy. There is just so much. And to start questioning everything, not in an aggressive, make wrong sort of way, but to start nurturing one's own ability to question.
Awareness.
Awareness.
Yeah.
And that it's okay, and that it's not only okay, it's mandatory. And if we start taking small, even the smallest actions and decisions based on a different life-based values instead of profit, power, penis values, if we start making choices, for example, we have a world where 15 million children die of starvation a year, and, what is it, something like 12 million tons of guacamole is served during halftime at the Super Bowl? And we have a sporting event that uses almost $1 billion, that costs almost $1 billion a year, and we could eradicate world hunger for $70 billion a year, and we're spending. So if we start making, we don't like the way women are overly sexualized, the way Halloween costumes sexualize little girls. Don't buy it. Women oh my God, women have so much power. Women have economic power. Women are 80 to 85% control 80 to 85% of all purchases across the board, from houses to cars to probably rifles is about the only thing women do not have a majority of buying power in. Women
so, you know,
control
our
the
real
first
challenge range. is to educate women, you know, not only why, you know, they need to wake up, but then once they wake up, is show them where their power lies. And,
absolutely.
And I think in a way, for me anyhow, and I don't know, maybe some of the listeners out there, but I think when I discovered Goddess, it not only did I discover that mythology, discover that spirituality, but I think what was key, and I didn't get this right away, I think I got it later, was when you figure out that that knowledge had been swept beneath the rug,
mm-hmm.
and what society would be, you know, how society would be different had it not been swept beneath the rug, then you start to question everything. You start to say, okay, well, what else am I being duped about?
Yeah.
You know, what else am I not being taught? What else is being hidden from me? And whose agenda is it? You
yep.
know, you just, you get skeptical about everything. You know, you have to take responsibility for your own education.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it gives you tremendous validity as you begin to uncover all of these different arenas that where our values and our worth as women have been swept under the rug. And let's not even get started on religion. We don't have time.
Right, right, right. Well, Kate, I promised to play some music to, you know, in memory of Lane Redman before the show goes off the air. So I'm really about out of time, but I've enjoyed chatting with you. And I want to mention your website for listeners so that they can go there and find out more about you and your work. It is unearthingvenus.com, unearthingvenus.com. And I hope, you know, dear sister, who you are now, I hope you will keep in touch, and if you ever have anything else going on that you'd like to share with listeners, that you will get in touch with me. And,
absolutely.
You know, keep me abreast of what you're doing and the progress you're making or any revelations, and you're always welcome back on the show.
The revelations are coming thick and fast. Thank you so much, Karen.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you so much for being on the show tonight.
My pleasure.
Good night.
Tonight.
Well, listeners, I'm sure you enjoyed hearing from Kate, a sister in the heart and in our mind, you know, like-minded. And it's always good to hear that more and more women are waking up and are carrying the torch. And as we come to the close of tonight's show, I want to remind you that next week I will be sharing some of those magical moments from my book, Walking in Ancient Paths, and also a Cathar prophecy I'm going to share with you next week. I think you will find that very, very interesting. But as I promised, I want to play some music in memory of Lane Redman, our beloved author, wayshower, drummer, who passed away just recently, and I am so honored to have interviewed her on the show. Please go back into the archives and listen to some of our past interviews. You won't have any trouble finding her if you Google her, if you don't know that much about her yet. She is worth your time, trust me. So I think I started out the show tonight playing her cut from Oshun, and I played a little bit of Invoking Aphrodite as we cross the threshold. But I think I will play a little bit of her final Delphic Oracle. I think it takes about 10 seconds to start, so if you just hear some silence, don't think something's wrong, it will go ahead and kick in. So here is Final Delphic Oracle by Lane Redman. And good night, listeners, and I look forward to being with you again next week.
Thyself.
above all things, speak the truth. Do nothing to excess. Accept the gifts the gods have given you. Choose not the advice of others. Make your own nature your guide in life. The king. The well-crafted temple has fallen to pieces. Apollo dwells here no more. There is no more oracular laurel. No talking spring. And the voice of the water has been silenced. All is finished. But here are my words. The muse cannot be silenced. She sings within us forever. Her voice will be heard again. above all things speak the truth. Know thyself. Know thyself.